I wanted to begin with a very basic comment, and that is nobody is saved by reading the Proverbs. Proverbs are not salvatory messages. That comes somewhere else in the Bible. So I imagine most of you already know that, but I want to emphasize that because I don't want anybody to think, well, if I do these things, then my final reward will be that of a Christian. No, we're saved by the death, burial, and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. John 3:16 basically says it all. So to understand the Old Testament, one has to see it in the light of the New. Now, I'm just going to read some verses here. I'm not going to make any comments about them. I just want to set the scene before we go to the book of Proverbs. You may ask yourself what this has to do with the text we're talking about today. That's okay. That's what they're designed to do. So Luke 24:32. This is the road to Emmaus conversation. And they said to one another, did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us on the road and while he opened the scriptures to us? So the understanding of the scriptures took place at this time. Matthew 6:21, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. 1 Corinthians, I don't think I have the right verse, but it's 1 Corinthians. I mean, I could say it's 11. I don't know. Maybe it's 14. But that's not the point. The point is what it says. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. Foolishness. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. 1 Corinthians 15:20-21. But now Christ has risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection from the dead. And then I want to do one in the Old Testament. This is one of my favorite verses because Jeremiah, who the pastor went over a few months ago, Jeremiah was in this chapter, which was chapter 32. He was praising God, but God had asked him to go do something that seemed, well, he didn't understand it. God said, I want you to go over there in that land that's soon going to be taken away by the invaders and buy something. So Jeremiah, being the way he was, committed himself to do that, and he gave a long prayer during this chapter. And during it, he said many things about the character of God. Indeed, that God keeps his promises and that nothing is too hard for him. Then he slept for just a moment, like we all do, and he said something about that land he was supposed to buy. He was kind of asking God in, I guess, a roundabout way, this little land thing still on my mind here a little bit, that you're having me go over there and buy something that you also told me to prophesy was going to be destroyed. So what's the deal? And then we have this, Jeremiah 32:27. Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? That's a rhetorical question. You can answer it the way you like. I hope it's all in the positive. Is this book practical or doctrinal, this book of Proverbs? It's practical. Now, when we say it's practical, what do we really mean? Absolutely. That's why it was written. It was written so people could get wisdom. And according to the book of Proverbs, there's only one way you can be truly wise. I mean, we do have... Has anybody ever seen a human brain? That's kind of out of nowhere. I've seen your brain at work. Yes. You've seen one, yeah. I went to an internship in the East Coast somewhere with a guy, and he had some brains out on the table. They all looked alike. I mean, you just look at those and you think, that thing is what generates all this so-called reason for man? Well, yeah, physically. But there has to be something else going on for you to have wisdom, and what is that? Speaking loudly, right? That's very important, especially if you got a guy up here my age. What else you need in order to have wisdom? Or without which you cannot have wisdom, according to the book of Proverbs. Fear of God, the fear of the Lord. This book, as we said, should be viewed in light of the New Testament. Now, David Gazik makes this comment. The book of Proverbs shows what the God-fearing man, and that's a good way to put it, God-fearing, man in this world shall seek and what he shall avoid. Excuse me. The book also teaches that man, irrespective of his spiritual blessing and under the government of God, will reap what he has sown. So that message sticks, even though we've been saved from the worst. We haven't been, we're in a position to hope for the best. But what difference does it make? I mean, that's a pretty logical question, right? You're already saved if you're a Christian. Just like that, through the power of God. You believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, thou shalt be saved. And that means believing on who he was and what he did. Identifying him as deity. Of course, that's who he is. That's obvious if you read the New Testament. You can't get away from it, even if you wanted to. Some people do because they don't like to be restricted. So what's the answer to my question? I was afraid you were going to say that because I don't even know if I remember it or not. I think what I asked was, okay, you will reap what you sow even after you're saved. True. Correct. Not only in this world, right? I mean, if I'm a mean guy to everybody in this world, they'll be mean back at me in this world. But what about in the world to come? When you go to heaven, is there going to be any, modifications done? Boy, I'm hitting a dead end here.
Your works will be burned up.
Some people would be given certain rewards.
Right.
Rewards. You get a reward in heaven. Yes, sir. Boy, I'm sorry about the throat.
What you're trying to get at, something like Romans 12:2, where it says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect.
Yes. It means although the value of sanctification is not the same as the value of salvation, there is still value there in sanctification because you have rewards in heaven. Now it would be time for any of you to ask me the big question that's got to be answered. What are they? I don't know.
Crowns.
Huh?
Crowns.
Crowns. What do those crowns represent? Yeah, there's crowns. I mean, I don't know. I could guess, but I don't want to. Yes?
Wouldn't developing a Christ-like character be a reward in itself?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what the sanctification process is.
Right.
Maturing and developing that character.
The thing of it is, when you're living as God wishes you to live, based on things such as the Proverbs, you're really not looking at it as a way to get rewards. Doing it is a reward in and of itself because you're closer to God in the first place. And you don't have to have any more sleepless nights or worry about what little Billy's going to do when he gets his driver's license. You could write a list every day of things that could go wrong, right? Right.
It'll save you headaches.
Absolutely. In our day-to-day practical life, it will be better for us if we follow the Proverbs. Absolutely. Although we'll have to take stands sometimes. Yes?
It will be emotionally better. It will allow you to sleep better
I think sleeping at night is a physical advantage.
Yeah, when you have to take a stand, it isn't necessarily going to be better.
Well, you're going to get, let me put it to you like this.
Middle Eastern Christians may argue that it isn't that much better even though they are.
I would say that a true Christian in the Middle East who's being afflicted because of his beliefs in the Lord Jesus Christ probably has a better sense of security and peace than a Christian that doesn't. So I get what you're saying. Yeah, well, they cut my arm off. But man, do I love the Lord better now. Here I really thought I could use that arm. As Dwayne Holmes once said, you know, he'd give his right arm to be ambidextrous. Okay, I think we can sum it up in verse 8 of, this is obviously Philippians. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report. If there's any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Now, what does that leave out?
All the bad stuff.
I mean, you can meditate on the bad stuff, I suppose, but he's saying don't do that. Meditate on the good stuff. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw from me, these do, says Apostle Paul, and the God of peace will be with you. Peace is underrated, I think, human peace within an individual. Hey, look, I can make a list of things I could argue about. I might even win, okay? But I don't want to argue about those anymore. It doesn't make any difference to me. I can't do anything about it. There is one entity I can influence, control, discipline, and regard in the relationship I have with Jesus Christ, and that's me. I think that's kind of what Proverbs is about, not in a selfish way. Not in a selfish way. I want to take a look at a few Proverbs from the next to last part, beginning at chapter 25. This is going to be consecutive, but I am not going to read everything in here. The reason that this is divided off a little bit is the first verse of 25 says, these are also Proverbs of Solomon. And that's the third time this has been said. These are Proverbs of Solomon. These are Proverbs of Solomon. In chapter 10, verse 1, and now here we have 25:1, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. Where did they get them? I don't know. They must have been around. Do you know how long a time period it was between Solomon and Hezekiah? I mean, was it like pretty close or pretty far? It's about 2 centuries. About 2 centuries. And Hezekiah had the wherewithal to ask his wise men to go collect those proverbs. I don't want them to get scattered and lost. And so the first verse I'm going to bring to your attention is the second verse. And I would ask someone to read that to us if they would. I'm most interested in the first part of this verse. I get it. I mean, I get it. I think I do. But why would God be glorified by concealing a matter? We'll go ask a scientist sometime who is hyper on the Big Bang Theory. And you can go back and back and back and back and back and back in time. And at one point, there was this very small, hugely dense, had all the material that was going to be in the universe. And that was a big bang, and that's the way everything started. What's your first question? How'd that thing get there? Well, you just don't understand physics, you know, or cosmology, they'll answer. They, you know why they can't answer that question? They don't know. And there's a lot of things that we don't know that God knows. And if, and since we don't know them and God knows them, we therefore know God is who he says he is, a sovereign God. The glory of kings or anybody else that is wise is to search out a matter. So that means you don't jump to conclusions. I mean, you're not participating in the so-called, what do they call it, the criminal justice system? American justice system. By the way, I think it was John F. Kennedy that said this. I'm not sure, but he might have said something similar to it. He said, our system of justice is terrible. We have guilty people go free, and we have innocent people go to jail, even die. That being said, it's the best system in the world, and it's the best system man has ever had. And he's right. It is the best system man has ever had. Is it infallible? You think the American justice system is perfect? I mean, just look around. You can tell it's not. Well, let's go on all the way over to verse 20. It'd be nice if I heard your guys' voices. So if you want to volunteer to read, that'd be great. Otherwise, you just have to listen to mine. 20? Yes, sir.
Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda.
Let's discuss the two things it's like, first of all. How many of you want to go out there when the wind is going to pick up and it's like a wind chill of, somebody said it was, what was it? 6 degrees. 6 degrees, man, that's cold. Who wants to go outside and take your coat off and walk around for, I don't know, 2-3 hours? In other words, that's not good, is it? That's not good at all. That's kind of torturous. And like vinegar on soda. Have you ever done this? My wife got a job at a nursing home 1 year when I taught, so I watched the two well-behaved children of mine, and I decided to do a little housework. Now, I'm sorry to all the guys in this room if this offends you. Not really. Not my problem. If you're offended, that's your problem. But anyway, I like housework. Always have, always will, I think. I like it. I can't tell you exactly why you like it, and no, I don't wear an apron when I do it. It's just fulfilling to me, and you can think about something else while you do it, usually. Unless you're Dyson, you know, carrots or something. Anyway, vinegar and soda, what happens there? Yeah, not good. Combustion, some kind of combustion. But who do these two illustrations apply to? In other words, who makes you feel or makes someone feel like they've taken their coat off on a cold day? Who makes you feel like suddenly soda and vinegar has come together? Who is the person that does that, according to this verse? I really like my mother-in-law, by the way. I think they get a bad rap. It says here, is one who sings songs to a heavy heart. What do I mean by heavy heart here? What do you think of heavy heart? Who would have a heavy heart?
Somebody going through a sorrow.
What?
Somebody going through a sorrow.
Yeah, somebody in deep sorrow for something, whatever it might be. They lost their job, they lost their mother, their best friend got killed, whatever it is. And here comes somebody along who wants to sing songs, pleasantries to this person. Is that a good idea? I mean, at some point in time, it will be. But you really don't want to go and pat somebody on the back and give them a philosophical speech about you're going to feel better. I mean, that, you know. Nobody knows exactly what to say anyway. But one thing you don't want to do is to sing a song about how pleasant the world is and everything is great to somebody like this. And then the next one, if you're in this is one that you guys should read too. So who's going to step up to the plate on this one? Yes, sir.
21.
Yes.
If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink.
They call that wisdom? You kidding me? Well, that's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? If you have an enemy, what are you trying to do? What?
Next verse.
Yeah, we'll get there. First of all, I want to establish what usually goes on in our minds if we have an enemy, whatever it might be, or whoever it might be, at least in a partitioned part of our life. We're not really in the business of making that person's life comfortable, are we? We don't send them money and envelopes. We don't write them little cards with poems on it.
The long-term objective of having enemies is to make them friends.
That's true. That's a good thought. That's a proverb. Yes, sir.
Don Corleone said, leave the gun, take the cannolis.
Yeah, okay. Now, it says here, if you do have an enemy, feed them if they're hungry and give them water if they're thirsty. But then in the next verse, it kind of gives an explanation as to why, what is kind of behind this. Now, who would like to read that next verse? Well, I'm going for that. That I like that, especially that very last part where he says, and the Lord will reward you for feeding your enemy. This is something that comes up quite a bit in Proverbs, and that is, if you have an enemy who is vanquished, you should not rejoice. You shouldn't run around saying, well, that guy's not around here anymore. Why? Why is that? Why would we care if another fellow human being got?
Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
What's that?
Vengeance is mine.
Yep. Yes.
But God doesn't want you after my death.
No. No. I think that is the point. And it's not so much that, it's a spiritual idea. Because all human beings, even the ones that we dislike immensely, like, you know, the guy that committed 12 murders and he's in jail saying he's, you know, a boogeyman came at night and the puppet, hand puppet told him to do it or whatever. We're not supposed to feel a sense of revenge against this person. And that's one of the hardest things in the world to do. Man, how many times can you go back in your head and think of a time where you wish you would have said something? Somebody tries to put you down or treat you like a peasant, and you just decide not to say anything. You actually did the right thing. You did the right thing. And the idea that you stay up late at night figuring out how you could possibly hurt this person is counter to what God would like you to do. You should pray for that person. That's hard. And I'll tell you how hard it is. You get on. I drove in an urban area every day for years. I didn't have an office I went to. I drove around to other people's offices. And I identified five types of drivers that just irritated me. But I didn't take it personally, usually, because they didn't know that. I mean, that they were not on the road to make my life miserable. They just happened to succeed in doing that. I had what I called the teen king, the guy that's got to go fast to prove he's a man. Dangerous. And then you had the lollygagger. Now, a lollygagger is a guy you're behind and you're in a hurry and you're going to an appointment. These people always show up in front of you, and they're like, hey, honey, look at that. And you're going about 10 miles an hour. And then I have what I call the senior moment people. Those people are pretty safe, but don't get too close to them because they may panic at the last minute. But I notice one thing they often do that drove me nuts. If they make a right-hand turn into a parking lot or a building, they stop halfway through it for some reason. And I'm like, why would they stop? I mean, did they go around? Hey, I'm in that age group myself. But Would you go around a corner and go, hey, there's a building over there we're looking for? You stopped on the street, man. Just go, right? And there's your soccer mom. Pretty good. Younger, better reflexes. But with all that going on in the car, I mean, you can kind of tell when it goes this. You know, somebody in the back seat just spilled something. Heaps of coals. It will be like heaps of coals of fire on his head. And that's probably true. That's his conscience that's working there. Let's move on to the last verse in this chapter, verse 28. Somebody had their hand raised. John.
A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls.
Right. Now, in my version, it means practically the same thing. It's someone who has no rule over his own spirit. I raised two teenagers. At least I say I raised them. They actually made it to the, you know, till the time they were older. And when I was a teenager, I had one thing on my mind. Me. That's about it. Oh, yeah, I would, I like my friends, my family, I don't know, they just get in my way. And so I didn't want anybody intruding on my young, independent self. And sometimes they did. And I didn't like that a bit. So I would take countermeasures like refuse to eat or pout. But the ones I think he's really talking about here is the people that go ballistic. Have you ever seen anybody go ballistic? Was it fun? I mean, if you're not involved, I guess it might be, but you got to have self-control. I mean, you're out there in the world as an agent of God in a certain respect because you're a Christian. I mean, you just can't blow up at people, even if you'd like to. Oh man, would you like to? You know you're gonna. You just got the perfect thing to do to get back at this person that just did something to you. That's when people go ballistic and they go crazy. And Jerry Springer has made a living off those people for years. I'm glad you didn't say anything, but you didn't respond to Jerry Springer. Never watch that show. It's fake. But what I'm trying to say is, do you have self-control? Do you have anybody in your life that just hard to deal with for you? Maybe not for anybody else, but it's hard to deal with for you. My mom did, and I stopped many times to talk to her, and she wanted to talk about Maxine, her sister-in-law. And she would talk and talk. She did this and she did this. And she was married to a professional man. And I think Maxine, and I never had any trouble with her, but I think she kind of thought she was kind of up here in the small town we were from and that my mom was kind of down here, although my uncle was up there, but my mom was down here. And so she kind of treated him in a condescending way. And my mom got mad. And I said, Mom, I said, look, like I'm the font of wisdom, or I was at that time. I just happened to think, you know, she's never going to slap herself on the head and say, boy, I've treated Mary Jane so badly. What's wrong with me? She's not going to do that. She is who she is, at least unless the Lord gets a hold of her. That's not going to happen. So you can control you. You can't control her. I'm talking too much about that one. How about 26:7? 26:7. Anybody? Yes.
Like the legs of the lame that hang limp is a proverb in the mouth of fools.
Now, when you read that, you start wondering if this isn't supposed to be ironic. So someone evidently is mouthing a proverb that they really don't understand because they don't have the wisdom of God. I don't know about you, but I have a lot of people explain to me what I believe in because I'm a Christian. And it's I interact if I think there's a reason to, like evangelistically. But They're almost always wrong. And if you know the Bible, you can point out how they're wrong if you think that's necessary. One of my nieces who went to a religious school and was considered religious and was in church every week, we had a conversation about something, and I told her, well, you could borrow one of my books if you wanted to learn about the Jews. And she said, the Jews? We don't have Jews anymore, do we? I'm like, okay, let's go get a piece of cake. All right? 17. 17 is one of my favorites. 17? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. So if you're passing by a big argument between two people, isn't it your duty to step in and make it all right? I mean, what are the possibilities that you'd make it worse?
99.9.
You're right. I mean, it's a pretty simple point here. What you need to do is just, is there anything you can do, pray about it, walk on. It's like, you ever try to take a dog by the ears that you don't know? The dog has suspicion and feels what you're doing is unreasonable.
Jim?
Yes?
In my younger years when I was in high school, I had two common friends. A group of us were friends. And two of my friends got into a fight.
Yeah.
And, I thought that the noble thing to do was to separate them after they took a swing on me.
Yeah, of course they did. Yeah. I mean, when people are up here with that level of intensity, the best thing to do is just kind of waltz on by. This 18 is especially important to me, but I have noted as I've discussed this with people, they're not very interested in it. Some people that are very close to me are not very interested in it at all because I talk about it a lot and how bad it is. Now, who would like to read that verse? 19. Just 19.
If the man who received his favor says, I was on the joke.
Okay, it is 18 and 19. Could you read it again with both?
Sure.
Like, thank you.
A man who throws firebrands, arrows, and death. If the man who received his favor says, I was on the joke.
Okay, everybody's got like pet peeves. Look, I don't want to open the Institute of Non-Pranking Associates, but pulling a prank on somebody has got to be the stupidest thing you can ever do in your life. And you say, well, it's just for fun. What's the matter? Well, for one, you might get somebody killed. That's possible. I tell you one thing that's going to happen, whether you think so or not. We have in the United States, we're the kind of people, somebody pulls a prank on you, and you kind of figure it's your job to be a good sport, okay? Until you pull a prank on somebody that doesn't think it's a prank. And it's not a good idea for you to try to humiliate them for your own entertainment. And you know what they're going to do at that point in time? Well, I've seen it a lot. You know, if you ever watched YouTube videos that are pranks, forget it. They're all fake. All of them are. But there are certain public pranks that are not fake. Most of them are, too, because there was a guy, sorry, Sherry, you've heard this a million times. There's this guy, and you make a lot of money off a YouTube video. He was having people taking showers, and somebody was squirting shampoo, and they would get upset because they had to keep doing that. That won't happen in real life. First of all, I've been to many, many beaches, and I've never seen a woman shampooing her hair on the beach. Maybe they do, but I haven't seen them all. And all of these women happen to be attractive women in his little pranky things. I wonder why that was. And another thing, if you're washing your hair underneath something outside and somebody puts some goop on your head from 5 feet away, you're going to know that immediately. And if you're having more shampoo on your head than you want, you know immediately somebody else is at fault, and you'll immediately look around. Something none of these people ever do until the last minute. I'm going to get off of this because that's bad. If you prank someone, their trust in you goes down. No matter what you think, no matter whether you think, come on, you're supposed to be a good sport, they're not going to trust you. I mean, I said I was going to go on, didn't I? Okay, let's go to chapter 27 and verse 5. Help me. Yes, Joyce. What's that? Okay. Yeah. That doesn't, I mean, if you just look at that for a minute and think about it, say, I'd rather have somebody come up and tell me what an idiot I am. That's better for them to come up and say, oh, man, I thought you could do a job like this. This is horrible. Than love carefully concealed. Why would it be worse to have love carefully concealed?
Well, there is a profit to an open rebuke. When somebody is telling you, you know, you did this wrong, there is a profit to that.
Mm-hmm.
There is no profit when love doesn't manifest itself.
That's right. And the fact that somebody is concealing their love, perhaps for you, that means they're not going to probably ever engage in anything that's going to be hurtful to you just because they don't express it. Okay, let's do verse number 6. Let me read these. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceiving. Judas, for example. All right? Faithful are the wounds of a friend. What do you suppose that means? What's that?
You got to link it to verse 6 because a friend's going to come up to you and give it to you straight if you're doing something wrong, you're not doing something right, or whatever.
Right. Going to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Your friendship's strong enough that he feels or she feels comfortable enough explaining to you that what you just did wounded them. But what about the kisses of an enemy are deceitful? Yes.
Look at Jesus' two friends, Peter and Judas.
Right. Peter denied him and Judas betrayed him. So I think what it's saying here is something we all realize. If you have a person, this often happens in the most ridiculous institution that's one of the most ridiculous institutions in the United States, which is the most unreal area. That never happens again. That's called high school. If your socialization is based on your experience in high school, just forget it. High school is not real. It's a phony system. And so you have people who are pretty smart people, can manipulate, want to be popular, want to be the big shot, want to be the beauty queen. All those people are free to do those kinds of things in high school with very little ramifications. You can't do that when you're an adult. Or not do it as easily. Let's go to 10 here. Anybody? Somebody want to read that hasn't read? John, if you'd read again. Now, that's one of those that you might just consider common sense. In other words, I think what they're saying is a close neighbor is equal in value to a brother that's never around, kind of the way I see it. Well, what do you guys think? Is that what it's saying here?
I think the value is better.
Okay.
He's a neighbor nearby.
All right. So the value of neighbor nearby is better. And when the word neighbor is used, it means more than just the guy that lives next door. They're what they call neighborly. Don't go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. And do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend. So friendship here is what's being propelled up. Now, Christians have two families. They have the church family, and they have their, what I would call their human family. And that blood bond is intrinsic within us. You can't stop being a parent. Doesn't matter how old your kids are. That is there. That drive is there to do something to help your children. And you say, well, gosh, your kid's a bit older than I am. You know, what are you helping them for? Well, what do you think? I'm their parent, right? That's the hardest job in the world, being a parent. You cannot be a friend or a pal to your kids. That's not your job. As a matter of fact, if they hate your guts for 6 years, you're probably doing the right thing. Your job is to produce an independent-minded, strong, responsible adult if you're a parent, not a buddy. If you treat your kid, look, by the way, I don't mean you don't like your kids, you don't kid with your kids, you don't roughhouse with your kids. That's not what I mean. But, you know, there was a time Sherry and I should have been put in prison. We should have been put in prison. I thought my daughter was going to pick up the phone and call. Well, we did something, we did something really bad. Oh, this was terrible. She doesn't have a phone in her own room with her number. They're the best lawyers you're ever going to see when they're at that age, I think. Well, you may have a fortunate situation. Maybe your teenage child isn't like that, but most of them have a tendency to be, quote, really, 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 really interested in them and what they perceive. If something helps six other people but hurts them, they got a problem, right? If mom makes the wrong kind of pizza for supper, they got a problem. Moms suffer, I think, more than dads do because they're so much closer to the kids when they're little. And that maternal bond is so strong that during the teenage years, there is kind of a look at a mother like, man, she doesn't know anything about anything. So much so that my daughter was under my wife's supervision to dress when she went to school, high school. And what do you think she did?
Closed at school?
Yeah. Took it to school and closed. But we knew one of the reasons for that. That was a swimming thing she had to do. But she didn't think it was wrong of her to deceive us because we weren't very smart. We're stupid. We didn't have the brains to figure that one out, so she did the only thing she could. Okay, let me end on this one, and I probably will have to end on this one. 15.
A continual dripping on a very rainy day and contentious woman are alike.
Go ahead and read 16.
Whoever restrains her restrains the wind, grass boil with his legs.
You know what that tells you? Leave it alone. You're not going to win. So I have tried in my later years not to argue very much with my wife. I said very much. It's impossible not to at all. You see, you know, all of us are alike in one way. You know, I figure my opinion is pretty good. That's why it's my opinion. But sometimes with a couple, you know, the way you do something is the way your spouse says it needs to be done. It's a big deal. No, you don't do it like this. You do it like this. That's a big deal. Well, it's going to be a big deal if I try to give a speech about why it's not like that. Actually, what do I care for? So I just don't argue anymore. Well, not very much, right? My wife is a firstborn carpenter's daughter. She has all the power tools. She's the one that knows how to change sockets and stuff. I do bull work, carry stuff, okay? But if I ever get involved in an intricate mechanical problem, she will be at my side, and soon I will be at her side watching her do it because, you know, she's like, well, what are you turning it that way for? What I do now is say, I don't know, maybe you ought to do it. Or what's your suggestion? Well, we're out of time. Next week will be our last lesson, and we're going to go to 31 and talk about a virtuous wife. All right? Heavenly Father, thank you for our time in your word. And may we take these proverbs to heart as you would have us do. May we be wise because we fear you. And we do thank you for all things and ask that the worship service, the communion service, does glorify you. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, amen.